questions you always had, the answers you were never given, the place to seek the truth. Welcome to Veritas.
Globalization is more than a process of corporate expansion, free trade, and instant communications. It is also about a radical ideology, a humanist religion, an effort to replace national sovereignty with global governance and deliver great wealth to the few elite. It is empowered by progressivism and other nefarious societal engines like Marxism, communism that promises utopia, but results in massive vulnerabilities for most people and robs those citizens of their basic freedoms. Are globalists and their unseen co-conspirators really seeking to control the world's power centers like puppeteers? And do they really intend to take over every aspect of our lives? Yes, and it's getting worse. In fact, those same puppeteers really believe they are superior to the rest of us, genetically predisposed, entitled to rule of the world. Tonight we discuss the deeper state, corrupt elites, secret societies, and the builders of an imminent final empire. Greetings, I'm your host, Mel Fabregas of Veritas Radio. Our special guest is retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, an experienced and internationally known expert on national security and foreign affairs. He currently serves as a national security and foreign affairs analyst for Moody Broadcasting Radio Network and Salem Radio Network. He is a senior systems analyst with BCP International Limited, an Alexandria, Virginia-based company where his primary duties involve working on multinational programs for the Department of the Army. He's the author of many books, which are linked on our website. Robert McGinnis joins us directly from Washington, D.C. Hello, Mr. McGinnis, and welcome to Veritas.
Well, thanks for having me, Mel. It's my pleasure.
My pleasure. And how should I address you tonight, by the way?
Bob is fine with me.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, even though we discuss the monster of globalism here quite a lot, why don't we begin by you defining the word globalism for our listeners, please?
Well, most people think of globalism, Mel, as a corporate expansion across the globe, free trade, which is, you know, for most people, a pretty good thing, instant communication, so you can tune into CNN or Fox News, wherever you are in the world. You can pick up your iPhone and talk to someone on the other side of the earth or in Antarctica or in the Arctic. And, you know, that's the typical view. But I obviously, you know, in the deeper state, look something much deeper. And I, you know, look at globalization, as you read, as a radical ideology, a sort of a humanistic type of religion. They're very anti-Christian, by the way. They don't tend to embrace and they tend to, you know, welcome open borders. They don't like nation states. They like global government. And of course, they tend to be very feudalistic. They tend to, you know, be Marxist to a certain degree in some of their thinking. There are, in my estimation, I identify in the deeper state three types of globalism, Mel. I talk about market globalism, which, you know, I think is pretty self-evident. Justice globalism, and we hear about that all the time, especially when you talk about environmental protection, climate change, and those sorts of things, human rights, obviously, but also religious globalism. I typify and try to describe this perhaps best as Osama bin Laden's Sharia vision of the world. And, of course, he would have had the entire world captivated by Sharia, his faith, if given the opportunity. And that's sort of what I mean by three types of globalism. So, you know, there are a host of people that fit the description. They have, as I'm sure we'll explore, their secret societies. They have great leverage when you look at the data over large segments of our culture and society and governments and the like. So it's a frightening scenario, quite frankly, and a lot of people are just not aware of the facts associated with this.
I have lots of notes here, and later in the show I wanted to ask you about two things that I see as components of what I see as their goal of a global one-world government. One would be a communist style of what we see in China. And second, because they cannot forget spirituality, they want to bring Sharia law, combine those two things. But we'll leave that for later. Now, the title of your book is The Deeper State. We've heard about the deep state. Is there a difference between the deep state and the deeper state?
Oh, yes. And of course, globalists are all behind this. When I talk about the deeper state, I'm talking about three layers. The first layer is really the political class, the administrative bureaucracy that is behind the federal entities. In President Carter's words, it's an oligarchy, unlimited bribery, complete subversion of our political system. This is President Carter. Even Bernie Sanders, not a conservative by any stretch of the imagination, says that money owns politics. Then you look at the administrative side of this first layer. And specifically, when it comes to mind, I think of Lois Lerner and her shenanigans there at the IRS in going after conservatives. I think of the State Department and the pay-to-play that we've heard so much about on Hillary Clinton. I think of the VA, the Veterans Administration corruption. I think of the DOJ Fast and Furious. I think of the FBI and Andrew McCabe and Jim Comey and all the brewing things today. So that's the bureaucracy. And frankly, I work inside a giant, the largest bureaucracy in the country, inside the Pentagon. So I see this and have seen this for years and years and years. So I understand how the federal bureaucracy works or doesn't work for the good of the will, or good of the people. So that's the first layer. And it also is important to understand that is often referred to as shadow government. There is a legitimate shadow government. That's not the one I just described. The legitimate one, and a lot of people may not be aware of it, is really the continuity of government. They're the people that, should there be an explosion that destroys Washington, the rats will go into all sorts of directions. They'll go to secret bunkers all over the National Capital Region. One near Camp David, one in West Virginia for the Congress, another for some of our spy agencies, another for the White House staff. So the shadow government is alive and well manned, well fortified, well stocked, ready in case of a national emergency. So you have those two types of shadow governments. Now, the second layer of the deeper state are those that are kind of the puppeteers. They're the political influencers back there, the lobbyists. And frankly, I've been a lobbyist for a nonprofit in Washington, so I kind of understand how to do that. Foreign countries, every embassy in Washington is not only a spy agency, but also a conduit for lobbying people on Capitol Hill for their particular interests in their particular country. Then you have all these interest groups. I used to be a vice president for a nonprofit, a 501c3. And so all of these, plus academia and other activities to include rich people, are trying to influence the affairs of government and, of course, Capitol Hill and decisions on appropriations of the $1 trillion-plus budget that we parcel out on an annual basis. So you have that second layer, and there are prominent people that I profile in the deeper state. I talk about George Soros. I talk about Hillary Clinton, David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, and others. They are typically in four different categories. You think of the corporate world, David Rockefeller, the political world, Hillary Clinton. Kissinger is the academic world, and of course he came into government as well. And the Soros is a nonprofit who, of course, fuels color revolutions behind the scenes, is a very liberal person when it comes to social issues, and not afraid of doling out his $12 billion as he has over the last couple of decades to all the causes that he supports. So that's the second layer. The third layer is really the unseen forces. I should tell you up front that in one of the things I don't know if you saw, but I've been in Washington off and on since I was at the military academy at West Point. And during that time, my mother worked here in Washington on Capitol Hill in the Ford White House, but she also had a job as the personal secretary to Gene Dixon. And of course, Miss Dixon, you know, used to write in the newspapers, known for her prophetic pronouncements, such as the assassination of Kennedy and the other foreboding things that happened over the years. So she even had access, according to a variety of writings, to the first ladies and the first families and White Houses for many, many years. And so she was in what I would consider the dark side. I've had encounters with people of all sorts of what I would call occultic, demonic backgrounds, just because of the many years working both sides of the Potomac River, in and out of government. I've seen things that, you know, show me that the second layer are influenced to a large degree by the third, the unseen forces. And, you know, when you ask Americans or even people across the world, do they believe that there are such things as occultic things or demonic things? And, you know, the vast majority of people in the United States, as well as the rest of the world, say, yeah, we do believe that there are such things, but how do they manifest themselves? Well, I believe because Washington, D.C. is a power center, arguably of the world, at least today, that if in fact there is evil, and I believe it's very real, and I believe that there is a unseen realm that is pulling certain strings of certain individuals, that they are very active in Washington just because it's the center of power. So, you know, those are the three layers. I believe it's been around to a certain degree, all three layers, certainly in the United States, for hundreds of years. I go back to the American Revolution, and I saw indicators in that time forward of really all three. So, you know, that's the background on the deep state. And of course, the globalists that we outlined earlier, they're the rich people, the deep pocketed people that have one world government in mind, that want to control all this. And how do they do it? They are the influence crowd that may have some unseen influence on themselves. And arguably they do. And of course, they manipulate, the very malleable political class who must be reelected and have to dip into a lot of pockets in order to do that. And of course, the bureaucracy that often, you know, seems so elusive to guidance and seems to be on its own course as it proceeds to the future.
And that's the religion of most politicians, not all of them. Re-election, folks, re-election. But you said something interesting that I want to dissect for a minute. Shadow government. Everyone thinks that as a negative, but you more or less portrayed it as something positive. In case, in the event of a catastrophe in Washington, D.C., we should have a plan B. Are these shadow government members elected officials, or have they been appointed by elected officials?
No, the bureaucrats, and they have been appointed. Now, there are some, of course, cabinet officials that are designated to go to certain of these sites. And there have been a number of publications that have identified some of these facilities. And I outlined them generally before. But, you know, they're manned by bureaucrats and guards and people of the intelligence community. And they are supposed to be ready at the drop of a dime to respond, you know, to a catastrophe. And, you know, of course, this all started during the old Cold War. I make a distinction about the old, which ended in 1991 with the collapse of the USSR, and what I consider a new Cold War, which is a different topic of my next book. But, you know, the shadow government has thousands of people working for it. They don't live here in Washington for the most part. They live elsewhere. They are, these facilities are practiced. They go through exercises to make sure the communications is working, make sure all the facilities are functional. This, you know, was because we were concerned in times like 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and other times that there may have been a nuclear holocaust that would destroy Washington, and we wanted the federal government to continue. So that was a legitimate thing, but it was after 9/11, when George W. Bush was in office, that they started to pour billions of dollars into these facilities, putting together the continuity of government, and they started to have a rather robust full-time staff. They haven't discontinued that. And so the fact that they haven't discontinued it either is because bureaucracies never go away, or it's because they perceive that the threat continues and, in fact, justifies the expenditure of taxpayer funds.
What guarantees, Bob, that we won't see, God forbid this ever happens, but we won't see a Gladio type, the cabal that's behind the FBI until recently, the CIA? What tells us that the same type of people might not be in this shadow government in the event of this happening?
No, I think it's a fair question. I don't think there's any guarantee that it won't happen. How many people, I know a number of FBI people that, were just ecstatic that Jim Comey became the FBI director. They said he was an outstanding person. He was, above question, an impeccable agent and so forth. And now, there's good reason to question, his judgment and certainly some of his behaviors and the like. The same thing with Mueller, and the same thing with many other people. I think if you don't have checks and balances in place, there's always the possibility that people will go rogue, that they'll think only of themselves and only of their best interests. And that's what often happens in bureaucracies, especially bureaucracies that have great power. And if you don't rein them in, they become like Lois Lerner and the IRA or the IRS. They become, their own fiefdoms, and they exercise that power that has been given to them by the people without good judgment that serves the people's best interest. So it could become a very scary situation if we don't have good people there. And I'm not sure that we always vet the people we're sending to these locations in the correct manner.
Look at what happened to Dinesh D'Souza. And thankfully, he was pardoned a few days ago, but they just wanted to make an example out of him.
Absolutely. And that's when a political situation gets in the middle of a, I suppose, empowers a government functionary who is just blindly taking orders because somebody said to do it. And we've seen that in Washington time and again through, the couple plus centuries that we've been around here. It's only more recently when we have reasonably good communications and people are willing to speak out that we recognize that historically we've had some pretty bad characters running the country and doing things that if they were exposed, people never would have tolerated them. So, I see a danger, certainly in the shadow government, both the one that we call the COG or the continuity of government, as well as the deep state, the political class that are totally corrupt in many cases, and certainly the bureaucracy that is a silent killer because they do whatever they want behind the scenes. And we can't even call some of these people to account in Congress because they hide behind, rules and regulations for the most part that they make up.
Let's dive into more globalism. I remember back in the early 1990s, I worked for a large financial services firm during the implementation of NAFTA, and I had to train American companies abroad about it. I had no idea what that and other trade agreements would do to my own country, not to mention outsourcing. I remember seeing American managers train their replacements in India and elsewhere. And it seems to me that that was a war that didn't require armament. And I know better now. Why did we let it happen?
Well, it happened, interestingly, because Bill Clinton was taken in 1991 to a conference that was put together by the Bilderbergers. And what happens at the Bilderbergers conferences? In fact, as we speak today, Mel, there is a Bilderberg conference going on in Turin, Italy. And I happen to have the list of who's attending, which is revealing to say the least. But the Bilderbergers, interestingly,
on D-Day.
On D-Day. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it actually begins tomorrow, but they're arriving today. The Bilderbergers are what we call the high priest of globalization. I just described kind of two shadow governments. Well, the Bilderbergers are the shadow world government. And when you look at over the decades where these people have secretly met, and they do secretly meet, though we know where they are, it's just a matter, nobody's supposed to talk about what they say inside. And of course, they claim that they're not making government policy, but everything contrary says that they are. In fact, a friend who's now deceased, Phyllis Schlafly, wrote about, the Bilderbergers in 2016 when they were off the coast of the U.S. and Georgia. And she said that, that included the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader in the Senate at the time, and they were plotting against President or, candidate Trump and how to keep him from becoming the president. They believe that it's their right to have open borders, to put together government policy at home and abroad. But it was in 1991 in Baden-Baden, Germany. They had their meeting. They brought in this young governor from Arkansas, Bill Clinton, and they said, look, we'll help you to reach your aspiration, and that is to become president of the United States. We'll give you money and support, but you have to embrace NAFTA. And so what did Bill Clinton do? Not only did he campaign for NAFTA and all the goodies that went with that, allegedly, but that was something he pushed hard for in his first term of office.
But it came from the Bush administration, didn't it?
What's
NAFTA.
That?
NAFTA came from the Bush administration, too.
Yeah, well, it continued. There's no question about that. Once it got started, it's hard to turn off. Obviously, with the current administration, President Trump, is trying to renegotiate with Mexico and Canada. And it's not, some people say it's not going all that well, given some of the, words back and forth across both our north and south borders. Barack Obama was taken to a Bilderberger as well, when he was just an obscure senator in Illinois. And they did much the same with him. And so they've done this with EU presidents. They've done it with others. As I look at the list of those that are showing up tomorrow in Turin, I'm seeing, a lot of just the Americans I'm looking at. Henry Kissinger, of course, a big progressive, and one that I profile in the deeper state. He's going under the guise of being the Kissinger Associates, which is basically his organization. You have Google. You have, interestingly, Peggy Noonan out of the Wall Street Journal. You have Council on Foreign Relations, of course, Rob Rubin, former Treasury Secretary. You have people, which I found interesting, Jim Baker, Director of Office of Net Assessment there at the Pentagon. And I'm going to have to look that one up. That's disturbing. Dave Petraeus. I know Dave, and he's going under the guise of chairman of KKR Global Institute. So they gather all these people together. They listen to speeches. They coalesce around ideas as to how the world ought to be guided in a different direction. And then given all the prime ministers and government leaders that are on this list today, they'll make some pretty sweeping decisions as to how collectively they should push their nonprofits, their for-profits, their governments, and their media outlets to encourage a particular direction on a series of policies. So to call them, the shadow world government, I don't think it's too much of a stretch when you look at this very, very distinguished list of people.
Here's the definition of the Logan Act for those who don't know. It's a United States federal law that criminalizes negotiation by unauthorized persons with foreign governments having a dispute with the United States. Now, when Barack Obama was there as a senator, and I believe Hillary Clinton was there as a senator, if I'm not mistaken, not as a secretary of state, isn't this illegal, what they do, being there as government representatives without being authorized?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, we haven't prosecuted people under that particular act. It goes back, a century and a half. But yes, they're not supposed to. But the same thing has happened in the Bohemian Grove. Now, it happens certainly in the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, when you look at that, that's really a byproduct of two very interesting things. You had Woodrow Wilson during World War One took all these smart people out of Harvard, and they went over to Paris, and they worked with the Brits, and they figured out they wanted to put together the League of Nations. Now, of course, when Wilson came back from Paris, in the Republican Senate wanted nothing to do with his progressive idea of this League of Nations, which was basically leaning toward a one world government, if you understand the background of Woodrow Wilson. Well, they weren't successful at doing that. But when they got back to New York City, there was an organization called the Council on Foreign Relations, and it was business people. And they were, you know, looking at all these markets and how to exploit the markets. They were trying to figure out how to do this. Well, these two entities came together and they formed in the early 20s what essentially has become the Council on Foreign Relations, and it exists today, and it's been incredibly influential. You know, who do you think put together the United Nations back in the 1940s? There was a cabal of about 47 council members that were working at the State Department under the direction of President Roosevelt, and they were to put together that idea. And in fact, Roosevelt wanted to become the first president of the United Nations. Of course, he died before that really was an opportunity for him. He was actually going to resign from the office and take that over. But whatever, you've had every government since, to include the present Trump government, that have had these Council on Foreign Relations people in positions of great influence. Now, why is that important? Well, if you consider the things that they espouse in their own literature, I read their foreign affairs magazine all the time. It has some pretty good material in there, but they tend to push global governance, open borders. They promote a variety of what I consider progressive ideas in all their literature. They even had, interestingly, the president of that organization, Hahn, came to the Pentagon last fall, and he said much the same sorts of things as many of them do. And as I indicated, at least a couple of the people that are going to Turin this weekend or tomorrow are members of the Progressive Council on Foreign Relations. They do some reasonably good work, but you know, it's interesting when you look at those that are appointed to government. What credentials do they have? They have, in many cases, membership in these types of organizations that usher them into these appointed positions. If you are not in this club, and Trump has never been a member of these organizations, which I suppose in a way alienated him from getting the type of support that past presidents have had. In fact, Richard Nixon, interestingly, he said in his own biography that one of the best speeches he ever gave was at the Bohemian Grove in Northern California, which was really before he was known significantly in the United States and certainly before he became president. He said that that was the most important speech that he gave. And let me just read what he wrote in his biography. He said, "If I were to choose the speech that gave me the most pleasure and satisfaction in my political career, it would be my Lakeside speech at the Bohemian Grove in July 1967. Why was it important? Because if you look at the roster of people that go to the Bohemian Grove, they're the Googles of the world. They're the prime ministers, they're the presidents, the people of considerable wealth and stature, and they listen to this. And in fact, it's interesting, back in 2016, when there was one such meeting at the Bohemian Grove, which is about a 3-week period in Northern California in the Redwoods, a guy by the name, who I happen to know reasonably well, Colin Powell, general, former Secretary of State, his emails about that experience were leaked by WikiLeaks, of all things. And
he was, you know, just saying all sorts of wonderful things, and all the things that they were talking about, it sounded as if it was a wonky policy presentation by people from around the globe trying to figure out the policy direction of the world. And that's how, you know, I think it probably is, based upon certainly the reports that have been chronicled through the years.
I haven't heard about the Bohemian Grove for a while. We hear Bilderberg every single year. Does Bohemian Grove happen on a periodical basis?
It happens every year, and it started in the 20s. A guy by the name of Harry Edwards started it after the Civil War, and it's grown. And of course, they do some weird occultic sorts of things. Some people say it's related to, you know, I suppose some of the Canaanite rituals. You know, allegedly they play some weird games. They want to do it in secret. They want to be able to urinate wherever they go and not could care less who's watching, because nobody's supposed to be out there. So it's a bunch of rich, powerful people just hanging out. And at the same time, they're also talking about things of substance, and they walk away with that, not only with relationships, but with ideas that do direct and result in policies that impact all of us. So it's not as if they're innocent of not doing things that are, you know, opposed, I would argue, to our sovereign interests when they're dealing with, you know, very powerful people from across the world that have agendas, that want to promote universal trade, that want to promote particular government ideas that are contrary to our own sovereign interests.
Now, from the outside, speaking of globalism, it sounds great. From your book, quote, "Most people would support globalization if it was indeed limited to making life easier. Yes, globalization gave us easier, faster travel and instant communication across the world, less expensive clothing, improved automobiles, better returns on our investments, and a food menu that is no longer confined to just meat and potatoes. These benefits, explain globalists, are made possible when supply chains cross borders, cultures meld, and capital flows freely across the world," unquote. That's what they tell us. But in order to have all these benefits, Bob, something's gotta give. Someone has to lose in the long run. Do you think if the status quo is left unimpeded, the one who will win and will turn into the newest world superpower is China, or at least the model to be taken around the world?
Well, there's no question in my mind that President Xi Jinping is a globalist. He's also a communist, but he's a pragmatic communist who has put together basically an occult following in the 19th Congress and in their own parliament, because they gave him a stamp of approval for ruling for life here by amending the Constitution and embedding, much like they did the sayings of Mao and the old version of the Little Red Book. They've done the same thing in China with President Xi today. So that's I think, a given. You know, when I think of globalists, there's an acronym that, you know, I've embraced, and it's called, it's spelled weird. It goes Western Educated Industrialized Rich Democratic. Now, the thing about it, you know, those all sound good on the surface, but the globalists tend to be, when you look at them, as I do in the deeper state, they tend to be divisive and prejudiced and small-minded and arrogant. They're feudalistic. They want to tell you and me how to live our lives. They want to control our climate. They want to control where we eat, where we live, how much we work, what we don't do. Even the likes of Ted Turner, who happens to be a globalist, and he's been publicly, you know, stated that, you know, we've got too many people in this world. Right now we're pushing 8 billion. We really only need about 500 million. Now, what he hasn't told us is how he would propose that we reduce from 8 billion to 500 million. I suspect it would not be a pretty sight. So you've got these ideas that, you know, date back, frankly. You know, you can go back to the beginning of
the progressivism and the globalism, I kind of see them almost synonymous. You know, when we're talking about, you know, the formation of progressivism, which goes back to George Wilhelm Hegel, of course, the the 17th century German philosopher. He was a professor, like a lot of people, just like Woodrow Wilson was. And we attribute to him Zeitgeist. We attribute to him the dialectic. The idea is being that man is getting better all of the time, and eventually he's going to be perfect. We've been around a long time, and I just don't see that happening. But yet, that's the philosophy that undergirds a lot of progressivism, and we've seen that in the likes of Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt and even Barack Obama through the years. And then they put in place these bureaucratic decisions or executive orders that kind of push us in that direction. So, you know, they're an interesting group of people. You know, when I look at the likes of Hillary Clinton, and this goes to a certain degree into the third layer, the unseen realm, or the occult. I've often referred to her as a Luciferian psychopath. And if you understand kind of my perspective, there is that it's not necessarily that she worships Satan, but that, you know, she basically is. She sees herself in a way that she's almost godlike, puts herself above the rest of us. She has, and according to Bill Clinton and some of the authors that have written about the Clintons, such as Gary Aldridge and the like, she's embraced, you know, certain Wicca things, certain black magic things, and so forth. And these are well chronicled by others. But, you know, she's sort of Luciferian. And then the psychopathic thing, you look at the behaviors associated with someone that's psychopathic, and arguably a large percentage of these people that, you know, are really the top of the globalist chain, like the George Soroses, who think he's God, or he admits to being mad, perhaps somewhat like his grandfather. But Hillary, you know, if you list her characteristics and tantrums and lies and self-righteousness and violence and foul mouth and erratic, uncontrollable, fearless dominance, you know, you go through those, and those are indicators of past studies that have said these people are psychopathic. And so you kind of put those two together, and the fact that Hillary, of course, her mentor was who? Saul Alinsky, the guy that wrote Rules for Radicals, who dedicated his book to whom? Lucifer, of course. You look at who she worked for when she was a young lawyer right out of Yale. She went to a left-wing California law firm that supported whom? Well, there were communists in there. They supported the Black Panthers. They did a lot of support for a lot of subversive activities. Then you look at her associations with John and Tony Podesta, you know, local residents here in Washington, and of course their associations and some of the descriptions about, you know, Marina Abramovich, who is of course publicized as Spirit Cooking Dinner. And
right.
And how she invited Tony, and of course John was invited. And we don't know that John necessarily went, but it's the whole. The whole associations there that in Washington, you know, when you understand the culture here, and a lot of people understandably don't, and I appreciate that. But having been here a long time, you need to understand that this is a cozy and insular world that we live in Washington, and that, you know, the politicians, the bureaucrats, the lobbyists, the journalists, the think tank leaders, the donors, the, you know, heavy hitters like the Soroses, they live in the same swanky neighborhoods. They go to the same nice dinners and parties. Their kids all go to the same schools. And they kind of are here to protect their own arrogant, insular world. You don't dare
question their authority. And if you do, they're going to burn you with the authority that we, the voters, have given them. So it's an interesting environment. And the things that I describe, you know, it is fairly pervasive. And so that's why I argue there are three layers to this. And the globalists, of course, are nothing more than progressives that have a global vision for changing the world. But of course, they're the elite. They're genetically predisposed. They will argue, just read their books. And they're so smart that, you know, you ought to just bow before them and give them your allegiance, because they're going to direct the world in a way that will take us into, you know, some great place, I suppose.
I wonder if the latest cryptic tweets by President Trump about the IG, the Inspector General, will finally tell us, give us a glimpse of what was in Uma Abedin's laptop. And I hope that that finally gets out so that people know what these criminals are up to. And somebody has to go to jail, because their perception out here, Bob, is that some people are above the law.
Well, they are. The case of this young American sailor who, you know, did a stupid thing. He made pictures inside the submarine, and, you know, he knew that was wrong, and he was prosecuted. He was found guilty. He served time. And of course, the president, pardoned him, but he was guilty. And, you know, I say, okay, he served his time. He should have been found guilty if in fact he did those things. But when they point out, look, you've got Hillary Clinton, you know, she had an unsecured server in her home in New York. She was, you know, broadcasting things that were highly classified, likely endangered lives and certainly national security. And all Jim Comey did is, because he expected her to be president and wanted to pad his own future, did not, you know, even hint that she was going to be prosecuted for far worse crimes than this young sailor. And it really has thrown cold water on the hundreds of thousands of people in the National Capital Region that have security clearances that are supposed to be mum about everyday activities, because, you know, we're doing it for the good of the country, allegedly, and we should, you know, be very careful about, you know, releasing information that shouldn't be released.
You know, going back to globalism for a moment, how can we stop globalism and even socialism from creeping up, Bob, if the future of our country will be in the hands of our today's youth, for example? The universities, they're plagued with Marxist and communist-leaning professors who are infecting our youth with their ideologies, like a cancer metastasizing everywhere. Talk about a threat to national security. What's your take on this?
Yeah, you're right. Well, they've gone after power centers, and the globalists are very bright, as I outlined. You know, they go after three power centers. They go after economics, culture, and government. And they've got a death hold on all three. And you mentioned education, Mel. You know, certainly look at the government-run educational establishment. It well deserves its bad reputation. You know, in many cases, it's terribly dysfunctional. The kids are not truly getting educated. They're learning how to be politically correct, and they're learning how to follow, you know, in some cases, some pretty radical views that are espoused by the leadership of our educational institutions. They're rewriting history. They're pushing a particular agenda, and it certainly has nothing to do with a conservative agenda. In many cases, it's a Marxist agenda. So the educational establishment, you know, and they want to raise our children, by the way. We are not good enough to raise our children. They know better than we do. So, you know, they have an agenda and they're pushing it hard. So the educational establishment has really a headlock on our children. And of course, that has an influence as they go home. Then, of course, as you would surmise, the media. Now, if you look at who is funding journalism today, just go to certainly New York and look at, you know, some of the schools up there. I went to New York, but I went to the military academy, which is north of the city. But if you look at some of the journalism schools in the United States, they're run by very liberal people. They're financed on the outside by the likes of George Soros, who funds them directly or indirectly through a variety of nonprofits that he runs. And then, of course, who owns the mainstream media today? All you have to do is go to the board of directors, who owns the majority of the shares. They all, for the most part, there are obviously exceptions. They are pumping us full of progressive ideas, and they don't report on things that need to be reported on. Certainly, you know, we saw how that was very helpful to Mrs. Clinton when she was running for office, and they constantly hammered Mr. Trump, as they continue to do even today. You know, calling, you know, his supporters, as everybody knows, a basket of deplorables. Well, we deplorables are, you know, obviously got upset to the point that we said no more of this. And, you know, Mr. Trump was elected, which fooled the mainstream media and certainly fooled those in the education establishment. And that's why today we're seeing, even in our best schools, quote, best, the Stanfords, the Northeast Ivy Leagues, they're all coming up with all sorts of excuses for their failure. And of course, they're pushing an agenda which is very contrary, I would argue, to the best interests of the country.
Give me a safe space to vent my microaggression tendencies. That's what you hear all the time now. I remember in 2016, December, I was in Hungary, and I saw more Trump stickers on the cars than I saw in the United States, because here, for some reason, people were very silent. People didn't want to say it. But you have the Czech Republic, you have Austria, you have the UK with Brexit. Now, lately, you have Italy. They're becoming more populist. What is this wave that's taking place? Are people finally realizing what globalists are trying to do to completely eradicate individuality, borders, cultures?
Well, yeah, I think so. Interesting. You said you were in Austria. Back in the late 90s, I went over there after the election of Jörg Haider's party, the Freedom Party. And it was interesting. And I actually interviewed Jörg down in Carinthia. And, you know, I think what got him elected, it was he was pushing back against the globalist European Union and their open borders philosophy and how we couldn't have distinctives from one country to another. They wanted to basically make Europe vanilla and at the same time allow unfettered immigration. And of course, you know, what's happened thanks to Angela Merkel and, you know, some of the encouragement over the last few years has really been devastating for, I would argue, much of Western Europe. But back to, you know, what Haider saw was, you know, we want borders, we want civility, we want our own culture. And I think there's a yearning all over the world, at least amongst a certain significant part of the population, that we don't want this one world government, this one world vanilla culture. And oh, by the way, we don't like the Western morass of cultural elitism out of Hollywood telling us exactly how to live and that this particular lifestyle is what you ought to aspire to, when in fact it's contrary to many of our faiths to go in that particular direction. So, you know, we've seen that reaction, I think, here in the election with Donald Trump. And I think, you know, for the balance of this year up until November and the midterm elections, the so-called blue wave, I don't think it's going to materialize as the Democrats hope, because people are beginning to see more money in their pocketbooks. They're beginning to see that, you know, the president is serious about the border. He's serious about trade, pushing back against China, which has robbed us of millions of jobs and billions of intellectual property. You know, it's starting to resonate with people that, you know, this guy's doing the right sorts of things, which is absolutely contrary to the globalists. You know, back right after his election, you know, they defined, or Mr. Trump, one of his spokespersons, defined globalism as an economic and a political ideology which puts allegiance to international
institutions ahead of the nation state. It seeks the unrestricted movement of goods, labor, and people across borders and rejects the principle that the citizens of a country are entitled to preference for jobs and other economic considerations as a virtue of their citizenship. Now, that seems to speak well across America today, and that's exactly what Mr. Trump has pursued, and I think thus far very successfully.
I remember last week or the week before I was in D.C., and I learned the story of, and you can correct me if I'm wrong since you were there, the story of President Grant, Ulysses Grant, who was a general, of course, before. And it, since we didn't have a Secret Service at the time, he would leave the White House and walk to a certain hotel there at the lobby and start, you know, having a couple of drinks. And all of a sudden, the power brokers would just come along and say, hey, we'll buy you a drink. And that's where the whole word lobbyist came along, when he said, just get out of here, lobbyists. Now, do you think lobbyists are one of the problems of this equation of globalism, since they represent big interests?
Well, of course, you know, the Saudi government alone has pumped billions of dollars through lobbyists into, you know, Capitol Hill and across the entire bureaucracy. They do it either directly by people showing up at a congressperson's door, or they do it behind the scenes through a variety of ways of funding, you know, campaigns, or they get papers that are written, or they do what George Soros does, and he, you know, creates these nonprofits that go out and energize people that in turn, you know, turn their ire on very specific targets to promote a particular agenda. So the lobbyists, I mean, there are thousands of them here. They're very well funded. They throw parties all the time. You have to be a real states person. You have to be a person of great principle to resist the, you know, influence that these lobbyists and their truckloads of money have in order to do the people's bidding. That's why, you know, I tend to like term limits, because, you know, if you swim in this, you know, snake pond long enough, you're going to get bitten.
Yeah.
I don't care how long. The longer you're here, the more likely you are to become infected. And I've seen some very good people just, you know, go off the deep end. And it's really a testimony to some of these people that they say, okay, I've been here 2, 4, 6 years. That's enough. I've done my duty. I'm going to go back to home and another job, and I'm not going to continue to, you know, take the taxpayers' money. Let someone else do this. You know, I've talked to some congressmen over the years that have had that attitude, and I applaud them for that. Unfortunately, we have some people that, you know, they come to Washington and you can't get them out of this city because, you know, they've become part of the problem.
Because they're subverted. Either they're subverted or destroyed.
Well, they are. They're no longer from Kansas or Washington or Alaska. They're from Washington, D.C., and this is their life. They like it. And they're powerful. They're respected. They have plenty of money. Why not stay here? Like I say, it takes a person of great conscience to leave that and to return to where they came from. You know, if you look at the empires of the past, the first Roman emperors, you know, they were basically dirt farmers that were raised up and brought to Rome to rule. And they were concerned about the simple things. Eventually, they too were tainted by the environment in which they were. And then they became autocratic and they started to do things that, you know, the people just didn't want. Now, we've seen that through the history of empires. And certainly in the United States, we've created this monster, and I'm not even sure we can get rid of it.
It's a hydra that was supposed to be here just to defend us from enemies, foreign and domestic, and perhaps to keep the glue between the states. But now it's a hydra that keeps growing and growing. I mean, look at our national debt. What is it, $21 trillion now?
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible.
And fiat currency, you know, it's
exactly
that, you know, we could pile it up and burn it and we don't lose anything. They just print more of it tomorrow. So we used to have something reasonably reliable. You know, the people that control the globalists, that control the economics, you know, just look at it. They control the big banks, the international finance, trade and business, health and medicine system. You know, think of Obamacare, science and technology, the energy programs, the oil, and the like. So that's where they focus so that they can control the world economy. And they're doing reasonably well.
I was playing Monopoly a few weeks ago, and it came to a situation where the bank lost all its money. So we had to research, what do we do now? And I found out that the instruction says, oh, just create it on paper. Just put on paper whatever the amount is. Then the bank never loses, is never out of money. And I thought, that is exactly how the Federal Reserve works.
Yeah. And of course, that's why we have, you know, this effort on Bitcoin. People want to have something that's worth something, not a piece of paper that says the U.S. government guarantees this is worth whatever. Now, we want something that we can hold in our hands. You know, it's kind of enticing when you see on television the commercials about investing in gold and silver. Now, I'm not a big person in doing that, but I understand, you know, why that resonates, because if I can hold a precious metal in my hand and I can call it mine, I at least know I have that. What I have in the bank, you know, is it can disappear in an electronic second. And I have no say over it because of what happens in cyberspace and so forth today. But if I have the gold in my hand, at least I can barter with that if, you know, push comes to shove.
One of the biggest concerns I had was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I'm glad President Trump got us out of that. What would have happened in the USA if we had become a signatory? And I bet you Hillary Clinton would have signed that trade agreement, which, by the way, folks, was signed by the CEOs of large conglomerates, and not a single government official was able to read its contents. Your take on what would have happened?
Well, no doubt that Hillary Clinton would have signed. She'd made some agreements. You know, interestingly, some of the speeches that she said that she wasn't going to release her speeches. She spoke at a Latin American bankers meeting and, quote, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders," end quote. That's Hillary from one of those speeches. You know, TPP, the president had every reason to get out of it because it was not in our best interest. It was robbing us of jobs. It was not a fair environment, just like the WHO or the WTO has become an unfair environment to a certain degree because of the likes of China, which has been dealing under the table and financing, you know, its own, you know, commercial enterprises to undercut, you know, the steel industry, the aluminum industry, you know, et cetera, and so forth. I just see that it would rob us of jobs, rob us of income and wealth. And if we continue to go in the direction that we're currently going, bar that President Trump is successful, as I hope that he will be, then we will end up a second or tertiary economic force, because by 2030, 2035, not only will China be the leading force, but there will be other entities around the world that will have already robbed us of the jobs and the prosperity. We cannot continue to be a country relying upon service industry. We have to make something if we want to sell something. You know, the world has to have things, and China understands that and has been incredibly successful at that. So, you know, I think that we need to kind of take a step back, as the president has done. We need to support these trade agreements that are fair trade agreements that encourage Americans to produce something other than services, and then we can, you know, deal with the other problems of the world in a more sanguine way than we have in the past.
We'll discuss more of these trade agreements and some of the CEOs that are behind all of this when we come back. But how can people buy the newest book, The Deeper State, and all your other books, Bob?
Well, they're on Amazon or in Barnes & Noble, and of course, You know, the more recent books have been published by Defender Publishing. And so, you know, you can just type in my name, Robert McGinnis, M-A-G-I-N-N-I-S. They pop up and you can order them.
By the way, folks, we're recording this on June the 6th, 2018, 74th anniversary of D-Day. So let's remember that. And also, you have an anniversary that you're celebrating today, right?
Yeah, 45 years ago today. I graduated from West Point.
Congratulations.
The fact that it took place on June the 6th, you know, as you indicate, Mel, it was a significant day in the life of our country, because not only did it announce the arrival of the Allied forces on the continent of Europe to finally go after the heinous Nazi regime, and led eventually in less than 2 years to the defeat of Hitler and his totalitarian ways. But it celebrates that free people are willing to pay a high price for that freedom. And I hope that we recognize that that freedom is in jeopardy even today, not just from bad government, but there are adversaries out there that would like to replace us, replace our freedoms with their own way of doing things. And I'm speaking of the likes of the communist Chinese, certainly Vladimir Putin and his autocratic ways, and of course our own culture, which tends to dismiss, the freedoms that we cherish.
When we come back, I want to discuss more of this. When people think of communism, it's a topic that most people don't discuss. And to me, that is the biggest threat to all of us. When you think communism, folks, think of 100 million people dead in the 20th century. And also the decadence of the United States. When you look at TV now, when you look at TV in the 50s, 60s, all the way to the 80s, you saw the family unit there. Now it's gone. That's why you don't even see the Flintstones anymore. I dig deeper as to why we don't see the Flintstones, and it's because they don't want to show you the norm, which was the family unit. And I know this topic for some reason offends some people, but I want to discuss it when we return. It's a pleasure to have Robert McGinnis with me today. Don't go anywhere. I'm Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas.
Thank you for listening to the first part of this very important Veritas interview. To listen to the rest and all of our material, proceed to the members section or subscribe at veritasradio.com. Don't forget to visit the Veritas store for MMS, hemp oil, pure organic sulfur, and other great products. Thank you.